Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by Stephen Dyson to talk about his fabulous new book, Imagining Politics, Interpretations of Political Science and Political Television. This is a really, really interesting book that does a number of different things in terms of marrying popular culture and politics and political science as a discipline. But I'm going to let Stephen talk to us a little bit about that. First, I'd like to welcome Stephen Dyson to talk to us about his University of Michigan Press book, Imagining Politics. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Lily. It's good to speak with you.
And I just wanted to ask you first to tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to this really interesting project on imagining politics.
Well, I'm a professor of political science at the University of Connecticut. And I started my research career in a very different area. For the first half of my career, I was very interested in political leaders and the kind of way that they make decisions. I work in international relations mostly. And then I made a big change and I started studying popular culture. I'd always been interested in it. I'd always thought of it as being a very political genre, a very political set of things, but I'd never seen it as something I could do research in. But I think there is a link because I'd always studied political leaders because it was very hard for me to take theories of political science seriously on their own terms. When I was working in international relations, a lot of my colleagues would study these grand theoretical constructs. They'd call them realism or liberalism, neorealism. There are all sorts of names for them. And they would say that these things, explained the world, and I could never see them as serious explanations of the world. And the only way that I could take these theories seriously was regarding them as things that were inside the heads of these political leaders and were driving their decisions. And so I always had the skepticism about grand theories of politics, of political science, and I always needed a way into them that allowed me to take them seriously. And I think the link that I started to make with popular culture was to say that academic theories of political science are just sort of imaginary constructs. They're not real. That doesn't mean they're not useful, but they're imaginary constructs. They're inside people's heads, the heads of political leaders, or when we're talking about popular culture, the heads of the general populace. And so I thought, could I make that link between academic theories and between the representations of politics that were in popular culture? The first link that I tried to make was between science fiction and theories of international politics. And so I wrote a book in 2015 that was called Otherworldly Politics that looked at the ways that conflict and cooperation were represented in shows like Star Trek, Game of Thrones, Battlestar Galactica, and tried to make the argument that these were real sort of representations of how the world can be seen to work. After that book, I moved on to the project we're talking about, Imagining Politics, which is about political television shows, not science fiction shows, but shows that portray political actors and political processes. And that's how I got to the book.
And I wanted to ask you a bit about, sort of the overarching discussion in the book, which is, as you note, about these sort of political television shows like The West Wing or Veep or Thick of It. as well as about the discipline of political science. And as you say, you sort of came at this because of the abstraction of political theories to help us understand the world. And of course, as political scientists, we are often dealing with the trying to see the world through these various theoretical lenses, as I also try to get my students to do in their work and their writing oftentimes. And so can you talk a little bit about how you sort of interpreted political science as a discipline through this construct of, I think, narrative? That's what I'm understanding from your work.
Yes, I'm the fundamental argument of the new book, Imagining Politics, is that it addresses two types of stories about politics: a political science story about politics and a popular culture story about politics. And both of these stories are not real politics. They're not descriptions of how politics actually is. They're instead kind of abstract interpretations of what politics is. These stories tell us to look at some things and to ignore other things. They tell us that some actors are important and some actors are not important. They tell us that some ways of doing politics are legitimate and normal, and some others are not. And I think where I would maybe depart from the mainstream of political science is in saying that it is just a story, that political science is kind of an academic story about politics, and popular culture is kind of an entertainment industry story about politics. But they're fundamentally homologous. They're doing the same, they're performing the same function. I think for the producer of popular culture, they would be quite amenable to this argument, because it's saying to them that it's saying about their work that this is actually a very serious representation of politics. The West Wing or The Thick of It or any of the shows in the book are not just frivolous entertainment. They actually, you know, have real sort of intellectual and social purposes. So I think they might quite like the case that's made in the book. I think mainstream political scientists, some of them anyway, are going to be quite uncomfortable with the notion that they are telling stories rather than doing these very sort of serious, rigorous descriptions and explanations of political processes. They don't like the notion that they're telling a story quite so much, but I think they are.
And that's one of the aspects of this book that really drew me to it when I first read it in process, was that you were kind of looking at the discipline and sort of unpacking it, going back to the roots, going back to the foundation of political science as a contemporary discipline, not necessarily the Aristotelian sort of argument for it per se, but in the sort of modern sense of it. And can you talk a little bit about, you know, when you sort of dove into that and unpacked it, what is it that you were finding that helped you to sort of marry these two stories of narratives together?
Well, what you find is that modern political science in the United States cannot, because of its history, be a sort of unbiased reflection of an objectively existing thing. And the reason why it cannot be that is that its own conceptions of what it's studying have changed throughout its history. I mean, the old theories of how American government used to work were that, you know, you just had to kind of read the Constitution and the great documents, and that kind of told you how it worked. And then you had a period sort of in the middle of the 20th century where the argument was the old documents and the pure study of institutions doesn't tell you anything. You've got to kind of understand the way that political actors, who are, you know, in some senses fully rounded human beings, behave in the political system, and they quite often subvert what should happen according to these great documents. And then later in the 20th century, you have the notion that actually these are not real human beings who are doing political things. They are these sort of automatons, these rational automatons who are just stimulus, you know, empty boxes in the middle of a stimulus response sequence of events. And so the conception, even within one subfield, American politics, of what the subject matter is has changed. Now, the reason it's changed, I would argue, is that the community that comprises that part of the discipline has changed the way that they talk about the thing that they're studying. I don't think the thing itself has changed. I think the stories that are being told by the community of people who are working in political science have changed, which is just a long way of saying that I argue that political science is a sort of constructed and quite internally focused community that develops its own language and set of meanings about what politics is. But there's no necessary relation between that internal language of how political scientists see politics and the actual objectively existing, if there is such a thing, real world existence of politics. It's an internally told story. And once you've made that leap, you know, if you've gone with me that far, it's not, I don't think, too much of a further leap to analogize communities of political scientists telling each other stories about this thing they call politics to showrunners and producers and screenwriters telling each other stories about politics. You know, is there that much difference between a Richard Neustadt, a very famous political scientist, and an Aaron Sorkin, the creator of The West Wing? I would argue that there isn't. They're engaging in fundamentally the same exercise.
And so in that capacity, I wanted to then layer on to this discussion of political science as the discipline that, as you say, sort of has been explaining to itself and to the world outside of it, this is how politics works. This is how we understand it. These are the terms we use. This is the narrative in which it fits. And then you sort of take up a variety of different television shows, specifically television shows, not films. And I'd like to ask you about why that, although I might think I know the answer. And then to some degree, how in these particular shows help us to understand politics as well as the discipline of political science?
So the way the book is structured is that each chapter pairs a television show about politics with a big theory or a big book, a very famous book from political science that seems in some way the natural sort of cousin of that television show. And works back and forth between the two stories to see in what ways are they telling similar stories, or in what ways does, you know, maybe the television show shows us something that's missing in the political science theory, or vice versa. And so it's this constant dialogue between these two forms of stories about politics. And so, for example, in the first substantive chapter, I pair the West Wing with Richard Neustadt's notion of presidential power and argue that both of them are telling similar stories about these kind of polymath, elite, paternalistic figures who occupy the presidency and work around the presidency, and how they are essentially kind of the teachers of the nation, which, you know, some people would regard as being a very good and progressive thing, and others regard as being a sort of patriarchal or a non-progressive or patronizing type of thing. And the book proceeds in that fashion by pairing these two stories, the political science story and the popular culture story, and using one to illuminate the other. In terms of why I chose television shows rather than film, that is an excellent question. Well, you said you had an idea as to why I might have done that. So I'm actually interested in why you think it was. And then if it's a better answer than the one I was going to give, I'd just say you're right.
Well, I mean, as somebody who also thinks about and writes about popular culture and politics, my answer basically is that the narrative space that television allows you is much greater and more extensive than even a 3-hour film, or Martin Scorsese making 3.5 to 4-hour films these days. And so that there is a lot more breathing room and a lot more space to develop and extend narrative constructs in television series than there is in film. But we do have very famous films about politics, from Mr. Smith Goes to Washington on. And so that's one of the questions that I wanted to ask you, was why television series as opposed to iconic film presentations?
Yeah, your answer was excellent, and I'll take it. So I think that was a big part of it, that there is a narrative richness, as you say, in the long form that is different in film. I mean, it's present in film, and film is in some ways a more sort of I don't know, I'm going to get in trouble, but a more multidimensional medium. You know, the film would tend to be denser, but you'd be talking about the kind of soundtrack and the shot selection and all the rest of it. I think television's richness is largely in its narrative, and that seemed to, you know, lend itself to my purposes. Also, once you've started down the route of television shows, you want to include some sort of generic comparison. You know, you don't want to be comparing apples to oranges, and it did seem that there was a lot of richness in comparing like for like, television show to television show, rather than kind of getting into comparing film to television. The other interesting thing to say, now that I think about it, I wonder if it's true that politics actually works better in a televisual form than in a filmic form. I mean, have there been more compelling, can you think of a film that's offered a more compelling representation of politics than The West Wing or Borgen, another show that I, or The Thick of It? I think I would go so far as to say that the television shows are richer than the filmic representations of politics, although that might be controversial.
I mean, I think you're right. And oftentimes in films, the role of the politician, be it a mayor or a governor or a House member or senator or even the president, is often a plot component. And you think about movies like Air Force One, which famously has, you know, the president fighting terrorists. But it's, again, it's a plot component, and it's not as much a meditation or a delving into understanding of politics.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing that went on that is sort of alluded to, it's not a central part of the book, but it's in there, is that television itself has changed during the period I cover. I mean, the TV show I cover are, for the most part, quite contemporary television shows. And if you think of the importance of The West Wing to not just political television, but television per se, it was one of the first shows that purported to tell a whole story kind of in sequence. Like, you can watch The West Wing out of order, but the story of the Bartlet administration is being told from early in the first term till after the end of the second term, and it has its own internal history. It's kind of creating a self-contained world, which did seem to be useful for my purposes. If you like, it's sort of raw empirical material that is potentially explained or interpreted by political science theories.
Yeah, I mean, I think that television does often provide a much more linear opportunity than film is can and often is, a sort of back and forth, perhaps in time or in space, in terms of analysis. But I did want to ask you a little bit more about these particular shows themselves, and, you know, to some degree, to ask you to highlight if there were any surprises as you were working through your sort of political science concepts and then trying to, or working with them in context of, say, Borgen, which is a huge favorite of mine, and Scandal and Veep and Black Mirror.
Yeah, so The interesting, I mean, all of them were were surprising in their own way, and it sounds like a self-regarding thing to say, but I think that method of setting the political science theory in dialogue with the shows allowed me to see both in a new light, and allowed me to gain new insights from both the theories and the shows. The thing that was surprising, I suppose, you know, a new revelation to me, was it concerned a British TV show called The Thick of It, which was a TV show that was about what are called special advisors in the British government, and special advisors, SPADs. I mean, that's what it was shortened to. SPADs were these creatures that were brought in by politicians in the late 1990s, and they're still rampant in British government today, as sort of these alternatives to the traditional bureaucrats in Britain, the traditional civil service. And the view had become prevalent that the civil service was running the government, essentially, and the politicians couldn't get enough control. It was sort of a version of the deep state argument. And so when Tony Blair's Labour government came into power, they were determined to exercise their own control, and they brought in this whole coterie of special advisors who tended to be sort of foul-mouthed and macho, and they like football and, bullying people and all the rest of it. And it made for very entertaining television. And I think when I'd watched The Thick of It when it first came out, you know, prior to even beginning this project, I'd thought it was a rampantly funniest TV show I've ever seen. You know, a totally hilarious thing, but I hadn't understood its deeper message. And I think working through the book, I got the deeper message, which is that this was a television show about the sort of end of centrist technocracy, the kind of collapse of the politics that were represented by Tony Blair and David Cameron in Britain, and by the Clintons and to some extent Obama in the United States. You know, this notion that what you had to do was be basically sensible, basically rational. And the image you had to project to the public was one of kind of cool managerial competence and rationality and compromise and technocracy. And that the joke in The Thick of It was the politicians were, frantic and essentially incompetent. And the special advisors were constantly trying to cover it up and would usually make things worse by trying to cover it up. But I think that really captured something of what politics was prior to about 2016. And it was this notion of managerial elite competence. And that looks kind of poignant in retrospect, because, of course, all that got blown away with, and this is in the book as well, with Brexit in the United Kingdom, with the election of Trump in the United States, where all of those old certitudes as to how you might win, for example, a referendum on the European Union, or how you might win the American presidency by presenting a rational, competent case, they were all blown out of the water, because what you really needed to be was a sort of, person who set themselves on fire, an outrageous clown who said all sorts, anything. And then you would get all the attention, and then you would win a referendum, or you'd win the presidency. And I think looking at The Thick of It in light of the line of argument I developed in the book, and also obviously in light of what had happened since that series ended, really gave it a new poignancy. It really is exposing a sort of hollowness that no one had seen at the time in that view of how politics is done.
And you combine it with Veep, and I believe they are both originally developed by the same show creator. And that Veep is also about a complete absurdity in many of the same ways. Can you talk a little bit about the comparison between The Thick of It and Veep as farces?
Yes, they were. They are both Armando Iannucci, who is a Scottish, TV writer, Scottish creator. They were both Armando Iannucci shows, and Armando Iannucci actually has a much longer history in mostly British comedy and British satire, before The Thick of It and before Veep, but it's almost unknown outside of the United Kingdom. And so you're right that Veep came after The Thick of It, and Veep was about as everyone knows, and it's in the title, about the vice presidency, which is, this sort of superfluous office, and there's the sort of core absurdity is you're very close to immense power, but you actually have no power at all. And that was the thing that Iannucci was trying to play upon, the absolute absurdity of being in that situation and how would it make people behave. The The funniest thing about Veep, I think, was when it did in fact intersect with real world politics. A glorious story about Hillary Clinton, which is she sent to Julia Louis-Dreyfus, the actress who plays Selina Meyer in Veep, she sent her a note saying, you know, dear Julia, I hope you get everything you want as Veep, you know, gun control and healthcare reform and you know, other progressive things. And Julia Louis-Dreyfus was delighted to get this note and she put it up on a dressing room wall. Later it turned out, it might have been through the Russian hacks of the DNC emails or WikiLeaks or some internal Clinton campaign correspondence was made public from around the same time when Clinton had sent Julia Louis-Dreyfus this letter. And the internal correspondence was between Hillary Clinton and an aide. Hillary Clinton wrote to this aide saying, a friend has told me that I should associate myself with Julia Louis-Dreyfus, misspelled, and the show Veep, and I should send something to her. But I've never seen the show and I've no idea who she is. Can you look for me and help? And this became public, and Julia Louis-Dreyfus printed out that email and put it alongside the initial nice letter from Hillary Clinton on her dressing room wall, because it just absolutely illustrated the point of the show, which is these politicians are one thing in public and another thing in private, and when you discover both, they become quite farcical.
And so in terms of the shows that are perhaps not quite farce, perhaps, although you do, you know, you do take up Yes Minister, which is another sort of slapsticky show that I used to watch a while back on PBS, as well as Scandal, which is kind of insane a lot of the time, and House of Cards. There's kind of extremism in lots of the shows themselves. Can you talk a little bit about how that worked with your sort of dialoguing with political science theories?
Yeah, another word for extremism would be that they are heightened representations of the thing they're trying to portray. And in popular culture, you do that because you think the thing that you're heightening is an essential truth that you're trying to expose. And so it's a sort of dramatic device to say, this is how I think the world really works. So in Scandal, of course, the politicians are sort of, literally murderous, and unbelievably cynical. But of course, that's not just frivolity. I mean, that is actually a fairly popular view of what politicians are like. They might not be actual murderers, but they are, in some sense, pathological. The relationship to political science theories is they are also kind of extremist representations or heightenings of ways that politicians actually behave. And the purposes are different. In Scandal, you know, the politicians are shown behaving in extreme ways because it's kind of entertaining, but it's also exposing an underlying truth. In political science theories, like rational choice theory, the politicians are portrayed as being, you know, utterly calculating and self-regarding. I think a rational choice theorist would say, yes, of course, they're not kind of human robots who are making complex mathematical calculations before they do everything. But that is a heightening or an abstraction that allows you to get at an abstract truth, which is, most of the time, they are going to do the thing that will best advance their political interests.
And in that regard, you conclude the book, as you've already sort of made reference to populism, the theory of populism. And in the chapter on understanding this concept and this theory, you bring in Black Mirror and The Apprentice. And you note also, as you sort of starting out the book, talking about the fact that the election of Donald Trump was, you know, sort of an interesting component of the analysis. Can you talk a bit about that final chapter?
Yes. So the final chapter is sort of also the first chapter, not literally, but it's the final chapter is about Brexit and Trump. And I think the phenomena of Brexit and Trump were the things that really finally convinced me to write the book. I mean, after the book I'd done in 2015, Otherworldly Politics, it did cross my mind that I might want to do some other types of research, and I might have colleagues or evaluators who wonder why I'm watching so much television. You know, would it really be politically wise for me to write another book about televised fictions? And so I thought I might just kind of leave the subject alone. But then Brexit happened kind of in the middle of 2016. It's a total shock to me. I mean, I'm from the United Kingdom, but I'd left in 2000, and I just didn't recognize what had happened. I mean, it just seemed inconceivable that the country could make that decision. And then Trump got elected sort of 5-6 months later, and there are a lot of comparisons. And that led me away from an understanding of politics through normal theories of political science and the quote normal TV shows we've been talking about, and towards trying to find other texts that could help me and others understand what had happened with Brexit and Trump. Political science wasn't going to help. I mean, political science had completely failed to predict either. In fact, was strongly predicting the opposite. It effectively said these outcomes are impossible. And in fact, the people who prosecuted the Remain campaign in Britain and the people who had tried to stop Trump, both his opponents in the Republican primary and then Hillary Clinton in the Democratic primary, they had followed good political science advice, or at least advice political scientists would recognize as sensible. You know, in Britain, make it about the economy. That's how you win referendums. Most voters are risk averse and they'll vote on the economy when push comes to shove. Hillary trying to avoid, trying to maintain a sort of centrism and trying to rely on kind of putting together a coalition that was where you'd identify voters by analytics and rely on demographics, and you don't really need to make many bold policy offers because you'll have a better kind of data and turnout operation. All good political science, all completely hopeless in stopping Trump and stopping Brexit. And so the texts I ended up with as ways to understand this new era were Black Mirror, which is a British techno dystopia. It's very well known in America through Netflix. That I think narrates or tries to understand the influence of social media and smartphones mostly on not just our political discourse but our lives in general, and largely argues that influence has been pernicious. And that I think gave us an interesting look at things like the influence of Facebook on the American election, the influence of fake news, and deliberate attempts to confuse people via social media and via untrue news stories, which I think had played a big part in both the Brexit decision and in the election of Donald Trump. And then The Apprentice, which, you know, once the man became president, really takes on a whole different valence. You go back and watch The Apprentice, as very few people, I think, of my socioeconomic class did at the time, but a lot of ordinary people watched The Apprentice and understood or took a view of Trump that came from The Apprentice, and you watch it in retrospect, and it's both chilling and fascinating. I mean, Trump is portrayed on The Apprentice as a very sort of powerful decision maker. He actually comes across as a pretty sort of reasonable and evidence-driven person, but he's also he's promoting or he's circulating an understanding of success and an understanding of power in The Apprentice that I think is quite important to his later political rise. In The Apprentice, he never talks about success as being something that you work for, really. Or he never talks about being successful in life as something that's based on preparation and kind of the diligent pursuit of, you know, education or generating a long-term reputation for trust or anything that we might usually understand to be the building blocks for personal or political success. Success on The Apprentice is, you know, sort of innately given. You know, Trump will say things like, you're either a good negotiator or you're not. It's in the genes. You're born with it. You shouldn't spend a long time studying a trade or how to be successful. What you really need to be is just bold and kind of take action, and you're an inherently excellent person or you're not. And I, Trump, am an inherently excellent person. And that's an image of success and an image of authority that I think was very helpful to him when he moved into the political sphere. But it had its roots in the American consciousness in Trump as presented on that television show.
And so I wanted to ask you one sort of broader question in sort of a conclusionary way. And the idea of, the title of your book is Imagining Politics. Can you talk a little bit about how the toggling or the dialogue between the citizenry, myself included, our understanding of politics that we see in fiction, on the television, and then at the same time that we see also on television, the politics that's presented to us in news. Again, we get it in a variety of sources, but how does this sort of imagining happen in ways that we may or may not even be knowledgeable about or understanding in terms of the influences back and forth?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, excellent point. You mentioned the news. This is a whole other genre of fiction. I think, like political science, the news presents itself as a kind of unbiased, straightforward representation of what is really happening. But of course, it's not. Like any presentation of the social world, it's suffused with choices about what to show and what not to show, and how to frame things, and what's important and what's not important. And I think if we were to regard both political science and the news as themselves laden with narratives and much closer to television shows about politics than we imagine them to be, we would be a lot closer to the truth of things. So I think that's one important way to address your question. The other kind of last thing I want to say to you is something that I develop in the final chapter of the book, which is to say that when we get into talking about Brexit and talking about Trump, and we say our politics is defined now by a populism and a sort of, weird view of reality that comes through that is represented by shows like Black Mirror and Donald Trump, it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, we do seem to have moved away from the kind of bloodless technocracy that was in things like The Thick of It and some of the other shows that I talk about in the book. And we're in a new era, a populism of the right, a populism of Black Mirror and Donald Trump. But the fact that we made that change shows that politics can be reconstructed in different ways, that the old verities are not necessarily always true, that through the stories we as society tell about ourselves, we can remake our politics. And so it should be possible to remake a politics that's different from the current populist era. And I think if you are someone who is not comfortable with the values that are represented by Brexit or the values that are represented by Trump, the sort of glimmer of hope is in just that, the fact that another different types of politics should be possible and there are other stories that can be told.
And so with that happy coda, what is it that you are working on now, Stephen?
Yeah, I say that happy coda. I should also, we're talking on the 13th of December and
yes,
I'm from Britain and overnight there was the sort of absolute rejection by Brexit Britain of a different story about politics that was offered by Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the Labour Party, a figure that many analogize to Bernie Sanders or to Elizabeth Warren in some ways in the United States. And so clearly the stories that we can convincingly tell about politics are not infinitely malleable, and some seem to take hold more than others. What am I working on now? That is a good question. A couple of things, but the one that's of most relevance to the book that we're talking about is a project I'm doing about Francis Fukuyama. Francis Fukuyama is a political theorist who whose big idea was the notion of the end of history.
I remember it well.
Yeah. His argument that at the end of the Cold War, sort of liberal democratic capitalism had triumphed, and there was no better form of socioeconomic organization that was possible. And he was widely interpreted as having predicted a sort of, Reaganite or Thatcherite utopia and being this sort of insufferable Western triumphalist. And that's the kind of, standard reading of Fukuyama as a political theorist and as a public intellectual. But there is an interesting fact about Francis Fukuyama, which is he also turns out to be a massive fan of science fiction. He writes about science fiction a lot in his own work, including in his, straight up academic work, as well as the popular writing that he does. And he also hosts movie screenings of, movies like Blade Runner or Mad Max or Gattaca. Science fiction dystopias. And so the project that I'm working on is, again, about that dialogue between a work of political science, a theorist, Francis Fukuyama, and works of popular culture, these dystopian speculative fictions that he seems to be drawn to. And the question that I'm asking is, if Fukuyama is really such a utopian, triumphalist prophet of the triumph of liberal democratic capitalism, why is he constantly fascinated by films that show Earth in about 20 or 30 years' time as an absolute nightmare, and largely as an absolute nightmare for reasons that seem to have been caused by liberal democratic capitalism? In Blade Runner, a giant corporation produces artificial humans, and other giant corporations have made the Earth uninhabitable, and is Fukuyama really as confident in liberal democratic capitalism as he is taken to be? And I think my argument is no, and you can see he's not confident by the fact that the futures he imagines are pretty dark.
And well, when you finish that book, will you come back on the New Books in Political Science podcast and talk to me about it?
Yes, I'll be happy to do that. I mean, this assumes that we can convince someone to publish it.
I understand.
He is hoping.
Here's hoping. Thank you, Stephen Dyson, for joining me today to talk about Imagining Politics, Interpretations in Political Science and Political Television. This is published in 2019 by the University of Michigan Press. Stephen, is there someplace that you would direct people to buy a copy of your book besides the University of Michigan Press website?
I wish that the brick and mortar local bookstores were still more prevalent and that I could point people to one in particular. I would just say everyone knows the classic place to buy books in addition to the University of Michigan website, but I also think it's important to support local bookstores. And so if you have one and it stocks the book, please buy it there.
Thank you so much for joining me today to talk about Imagining Politics.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.